at session number 30388, reel 11.
Six of us, plus an officer whose name I mentioned to you before, Jock Forrest, the Scotsman who was a school teacher in civilian life, where a part of Fetis was being used by the Royal Navy as a research center into the German mine warfare system, and was full of boffins. They were all officers, of course, specialized in acoustics and specialized in magnetics, specialized in contact pressure and so on. And we were given a lot of bumf, which came from Peenemünde in Germany, which was experimental stuff on mines and mine sweeping, and we were required to translate that without any access to technical translation, to technical dictionaries. We were up there for 6-7 months. James and I, as I said, was one of the people who went. We were good friends. We saw his picture there, leaning against the monument. There was no barracks, and there was no catering for us. So we had our breakfast in a forces canteen, which for the whole time I was there consisted of streaky bacon and baked beans, bread, marge, sometimes a bit of marmalade and tea. As for main meals, the Navy showed some sense for once, because they catered for all the officers, said, all right, let the petty officers have the same, or the enlisted ranks have the same. And we were working in this office for all this time translating. It was heavy going, and we often had to go to the various departments to get the specialists to explain to us what some convoluted German term might mean to them. And I say might because the Germans have a way of conjoining words, like saying, instead of saying a locking nut, they will say a nut for locking this to that and something else because of this, in one word. So sometimes it got convoluted, sometimes the technical terms were beyond us. Although James had some engineering training, he was pretty good at it. I had a lot of experiences in Edinburgh. I don't want to call you here for another session unless you fancy the idea. I had a lot of experience in Edinburgh. I used to go dancing regularly and met a very nice young girl there, a nice local girl who was married to an American major who had been transferred to Germany. But she was a dancer out of this world. And I just met her to dance with her and so on, and I knew my place myself. And she always brought a girlfriend along as a chaperone anyway, so. But it was a fantastically good relationship. On the dance floor, we were unbelievable. I also used to go to concerts in the Usher Hall with James. I remember we went to listen to a world famous violinist, Jeanette Neveu, playing Mendelssohn's violin concerto, which is very difficult to play. She got killed in an air crash a few years later. And we were sitting in the front row, and she was really working at it because she was breathing as she was bowing. It's very hard work, and it was very, very good. But we went to the theatre and all that sort of thing. I had digs with another one of our crew. We shared a room in a basement in an old Georgian terrace. In fact, it was Regal Terrace, that's right, not far from Waverley Station. It was a large Georgian sort of house and subdivided into flats, and in the basement lived the landlady who was looking after the property and so on and so forth, Peggy, a lady of a somewhat dubious reputation. And there we had a few adventures. For one thing, I had a terrible tooth infection whilst I was there. And I was sent to naval dentists, and they discovered that my wisdom tooth here was growing this way and pushing all my teeth that way. And the only way to get it out was to split it. And I was over an hour and a half in the chair there whilst two dentists attempted to get the bits out of me at the time, pumping me full of painkillers. By the time I got home, I had a temperature of about 103. And it took me about 3 days to get over that. It was quite a nasty thing to have happened. We had quite nice neighbours. There were three school teachers from the Isle of Skye living in the flat that above, on the first floor, on the ground floor. And we got fairly friendly with them and used to take them out now and again dancing, quite innocent. But our main occupation was to go with our own pals on drinking sprees into Rose Street in Edinburgh, which was a street with about 24 pubs in, which we tried to drink our way up one side and down the other and never managed. I know that after about two pubs, I used to stand on one of the tables singing a very famous ballad of the time called J'attendrai in French. J'attendrai le jour et la nuit, j'attendrai toujours mon amour. You know, it was a very famous thing. One of the French stars used to sing that. And I always got free drinks as a result. I found that, Edinburgh left me cold in a manner of speaking, you know. Certainly, as far as the girls were concerned, they weren't anywhere near as friendly as the Abertonians had been. But we worked very, very hard, and eventually we finished the job and were sent back to Chatham Barracks. At Chatham, they decided that, as I was by that time a petty officer, writer special, I was lodged in the neighbouring Collingwood Barracks, in the Chiefs and Petty Officers Mess, and decided, as I was a petty officer writer, they would put me in charge of the demobilisation section, which was underground in the so-called tunnels there. And I tried to explain, I'm not a writer, I'm a writer special. You're a writer? No, I'm a writer SP, I'm not a clerk. Ah, you'll take charge of that. And they put me in charge of a section of about seven chaps, or 10 chaps, and every day we had to vet all those who were about to be discharged. And it was done on the basis of a combination of age and length of service. And we had to vet this, get all the papers in order. I had a special authority to go into the records rooms, which very few people had, to check up, you know, the real records that never left that place. And we came across a few oddities, like some people came up to be demobilized with all their paper already and eager to go. And by the time the papers had reached me via the writers and I was checking them through before taking them to the office for signature, I saw, he did 56 days detention. That doesn't count towards naval service. Knock that off the legs of service. He's not due for demob for another 2 weeks. And I would tell this poor so-and-so, I'm afraid you'll have to come back in 2 weeks' time. What? What's the matter? You had 56 days in 1943 in HMS such and such for assaulting a senior rating. Oh, I've forgotten all about that. I said, yeah, the Navy hasn't forgotten all about it. Doesn't count towards your service, so I'm afraid, come back in 2 weeks. I had to give that message to the then middleweight boxing champion of the Royal Navy, who took it on the chin, as they say. I never had any unpleasantness, to be honest. That's, once I was doing this job, on one day, there was a tannoy, Petty Officer Gartenberg, to report to the wardroom at the double. Now, petty officers were never asked to do anything at the double. That was for the lower ranks. You went to the smart bit at the double. Oh, blimey. So I ran. I got there to the wardroom, and reported to the duty officer, "Oh, there's a phone call for you from Germany." Now, I had been friendly whilst in Chatham with an American lady soldier who was stationed in London, who was actually German origin, like myself, who was Jewish and so on. She was a very nice girl. In fact, I've got a picture still in here. And she had been transferred to Germany a few weeks before, and I thought, God, I don't know how she managed. She's wangled somehow a priority phone call to me. So I picked up the phone, expecting to hear a girl's voice, and the man answers in German, "Is that you, Rolf?" My name in Germany was Rolf, as in Rolf Harris. "Is that you, Rolf?" I said, "Yes, who's that?" "This is Hans." All in German, of course. I said, "Hans?" "Yes, Hans Nisten, your oldest friend." Now, Hans Nisten and I first met as 3-year-olds when we attended the same nursery school in the German small town where we lived. And Hans was the middle one of 3 brothers. And my mother's half-sister had survived in Germany throughout the war, unmolested, because she had married a non-Jewish man. They'd moved away from an area where they were known. They went, in fact, to live in Essen, one of the most bombed cities, the Sheffield of Germany. And he was a draftsman, and somehow he managed to stay alive. And when they resurfaced after the war, they got in touch with my parents, and they said, "Well, go back to the small town, see what you can do about our property, which had been forcibly acquired by somebody else, and take it over," and so on. And as a result, they settled back in there. And she met this boy's mother in the street, who immediately asked after my family. And she asked after her family, and the result was that she discovered that the eldest son, whom I didn't like, was killed in the war, and that Hans, who was a medical orderly in the German army, had been wounded in Poland in 1945, was sent home on convalescent leave, and volunteered himself as a prisoner to the American army, who were by that time advancing in the Rhineland in the area near Cologne. So he was taken prisoner by the Germans whilst on convalescent leave, by the Americans, and as he spoke good English, the major in charge of this particular camp used him as his personal interpreter, befriended him, offered to sponsor his visit to America for the purpose of studying medicine and stuff like that. And in the course of conversation, learned about me. So when Hans told him about me, you know, and he said, "Well, there can't be many Gartenbergs in the British Navy, let's call them up." And he put a call through to the Admiralty and said, "You got a sailor called Gartenberg, where is he?" And they said, "In Chatham Barracks." "Here's the number." They gave him the number. He rang up, and there am I, standing in the wardroom with about 100 officers listening in to me talking away animatedly in German to this fellow. We had a long conversation and promised to meet each other and so on once things had quieted down. And in fact, I saw him last year. I visited him. He's a very sick man. Anyhow, we had half a last conversation on a priority line. And when I put the phone down, one young officer came up to me and he said, "I say, petty officer, are you a spy by any chance?" I said, "Something of the sort, because I was in naval intelligence." So that was an adventure that was quite amazing. In the meantime, I was running this department and getting rid of 200-odd people a day we were processing. And then suddenly I had a call to report to a HMS president here on the Thames in London, Admiralty. And I was seconded to an office in Great Smith Street, where a certain Captain Richards had a small section that was looking into German torpedo experimental stuff, like similar to what we'd done in Scotland. And there were three of us doing this. When I got there, there was one woman, petty officer, Wren petty officer, doing that, whose father was later to become a customer of mine, and James and myself. So I lived on the Thames, on the boat, for a while, and we worked in this little office, and it was very nice because Captain Richards was a lovely old boy. He wasn't pulling rank or anything like that, you know. And James, whose wife and small son were living in Bristol at the time, every weekend he got letting go at about 10, 12 o'clock on a Friday and said to go home to visit wife and family, and so long as he's back by midday on Monday, that's all right, sort of thing. We didn't mind. The Wren only a couple of weeks with us, and then she was demobilized. But she left behind a book of naval meal vouchers. And they were so constructed that if you used them, you would write, it had to be signed by an officer, Joe Smith plus eight others or something like that. And they would get nine meals out of it. Well, this... Should I shut the windows, by the way, to cut out the noise? Sorry. She left this book of meal vouchers. So we appropriated it, forged an officer's signature, put the office stamp on it, but did it in a shaky sort of way so that it wasn't identifiable, and ate out to Joe Lyons for about 3 weeks on the Navy. Sometimes inviting friends of ours. It was very naughty. Whilst there, I learnt that, I'm coming near to the end, by the way, I learnt that I was entitled to compassionate leave to visit my family, whom I had not seen or had not seen for 8.5 years. So I put in an application. My family were living in Tel Aviv, in Palestine, as it was. And I knew Palestine was out of bounds for leave, and you know what the times were like. And I was summoned to see a lieutenant commander in naval intelligence who gave me a very, very thorough grilling about my political and other views and so on. And in the end, the Navy said, yes, we'll send you. So I was sent as a passenger to Portside in the aircraft carrier HMS Indomitable. Being a petty officer writer has its disadvantages. When I, as a passenger, boarded this, an officer, a commander, collared me and he said, "You're just the man I'm looking for." I said, "Sir, I need a petty officer writer to take charge of a small section checking the ship's manifest of passengers against the documents received from the passengers." So I said, "Excuse me, sir, I'm not a writer. I'm an intelligence man. I'm a writer, SB, special. I'm not interested in that. You do the job I'm telling you to do." He was very, very shirty. So I was taken to an office. There were about six writers sitting there. I told them that I'd been put in charge of them, and I made it clear to them I knew nothing whatsoever about this. I was not a writer as such. That was a cover for the work that I had been doing. And I said, all I want you to do is to help me along to get this thing right. Well, there were about 1,200 passengers on board. These were troops being taken to the Far East. And checking one against the other when you've got piles of documents is no easy job. But anyway, it took us 2 days. And after we'd finished, we had the right number of people, But there was one name on the passenger list that did not correspond to one of the names who was actually on board. So I reported, I was told to report to this commander, and I went to see this man, and I said, told him what had happened. I said, I can't reconcile one name with one on the list. Have you got the right number? Aye, sir. Right. Wait here. And he disappeared for about half an hour. And he came back. He said, you've done very well. There's one man was taken ill just as he was about to board. So they took him off and substituted somebody else who was not due to go on board. So I found myself in port side. The rest of the time I spent marching up and down the flight deck in the sun, watching the dolphins. And got to port side, reported to the naval base. And they said, we don't need a German expert here. I said, I know you don't. I'm on my way to Palestine for leave. You can't go to Palestine for leave. It's out of bounds. I said, well, the Admiralty have given me permission to go. Impossible. Where's your paperwork? I said, they didn't give me any paperwork. Just a warrant to hear. So there was radio communication. In the meantime, they put me in charge of defaulters, of prisoners, rather. There were two prisoners. One was a sailor, a naval chappie who was accused by some woman of easy virtue of having raped her or something. He was in very serious trouble anyway. And the other one was a locally enlisted Jewish Palestinian naval cook who spoke no English, or very little, but served in the Royal Navy and tried to swindle the rabbi in Port Said out of £5 by telling his wife, after he'd been a guest there for dinner, and the rabbi had to go out, telling his wife, the husband said, you can give me £5. And when he came back, he was furious, reported him, and so on. So he was in clink. And I had to sort of accompany these two guys, communicate with them. I won't go into the details. This fellow claimed to know my father when he heard my name, which was partially true, but not entirely. Eventually, they put me on board a destroyer to Haifa. And this was one of the ships that was engaged in intercepting these illegal immigrant vessels. We're talking 1946. And the crew hated the job. They really were, as one man, the chiefs and petty officers, rather be fighting the Germans and so than this poor buckers and all this sort of thing. When I got to Haifa, I reported to the naval headquarters there, and the chap on the desk there, I said, I want transport to Tel Aviv. He said, you can't go to Tel Aviv. Tel Aviv is out of bounds. I said, look, I've come all the way from England to visit my parents who live in Tel Aviv. He said, you can't go there. I was more ranked than he, and when I shout, leave me and hear me a mile away, especially in those days before taking medication to keep my voice down a bit. I started shouting at this fellow. And an officer appeared, and when he heard what I had to say, he told the man, give this man a travel warrant and provide him with transport to the bus station. So they took me to the bus station. Remember, I was in full naval uniform, and put me on a bus to Tel Aviv. I spoke to the driver in what I hope was something like Yiddish, you know, the lingua franca, which European Jews use quite a lot, which has some similarity to German. And I said, you know, I'm from here, I'm a Jewish boy, sort of thing, you know. I didn't want to be rescued or anything, you see. And he said, sit at the back of the bus. And I sat at the back and we went to Tel Aviv. And I got off with my gear in the bus station. I hadn't been able to tell my parents that I was coming. They knew I was coming sometime, but not when. And a taxi driver approached me and said in English with a strong German accent, do you want a taxi? So I replied in German. And he was lovely. He took me to my parents' flat, and he went up ahead of me to warn my mother that I was there. And so I spent 2 weeks, they gave me, there. And after the 2 weeks were up, I applied for an extension with the assistance of the military police captain at the police place there. And he said, I'll delay the thing as much as I can. You'll have at least 3 weeks before they call you if they turn you down. But they actually gave me a two-week extension. So after 4 weeks, I was back in the Navy house, and I had the awful experience of watching one of these illegal immigrant ships being brought into Haifa Harbor with naval personnel running the ship, an army waiting to take them off the ship and take them onto the barbed wire boats to Cyprus, because they were being transshipped to Cyprus. And these ships had barbed wire all around the... And some of them on this tub that arrived tried to jump overboard and swim ashore, but they had patrol boats out there picking them out of the water, and nobody got out. They had fights with the army when they were being made to go. They never touched the naval blokes. I watched this from the top of Navy House, and the next day I was on a train to Egypt, and I palled up with a young soldier, and we got to Kantara on the canal. I had to wait a while to get a ferry across, went across to the railway station in Ismailia to catch a train to Port Said. There somebody tried to run us down with a luggage trolley, a big one, but desisted when my soldier friend waved his rifle at them. Got to Port Said, spent the night there, and the next day joined a troop ship for Liverpool. And there, for the one and only time in my naval career, I was seasick. This was, in peacetime, a liner. It was full of troops coming back from the Far East. The stench in the heads was unimaginably terrible. And when I went in the morning there, I just threw up. But after I'd had a wash and a quietened down, I went and had a full breakfast. And it's the only time in the Navy that I was seasick, on the biggest ship I was on. It was a 36,000 tonner or something like that. To Liverpool, back to Chatham, a couple of weeks, and it was my turn. And I finished my inglorious career after receiving my documents, excuse me, and my paychecks and whatnot. I had to go and queue up for civilian clothing. And I joined this queue, and a medical rating comes out of the office outside which this queue was standing, walks up to me and said, what are you doing here, petty officer? I said, I'm here for my demob suit. Oh no, he said, you're in the wrong place. Your demob suits are around the corner, two doors away. This lot all got VD. So I went round the corner, collected my demob suit, went to the station, and I took a train to Southfields, believe it or not, where I'd found some lodgings. And that ended my undistinguished service. I think I've cut it a little bit shorter than I might have done, but